If you've been told to pull your socks up recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Welcome back, everybody. You are here on the Up Your Brave show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh on Reality Check Radio. And today I'm talking to Kirstie Marie Denny on the topic of neurodiversity controversy. What's going on with our kids? Welcome to the show, Kirstie.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
I am so thrilled to dive deeper into this topic. It's going to be amazing for those of you that know somebody, or maybe it's you, and that you would use the phrase neurodiverse. This is going to be really interesting for you. Before we dive in, for those of you that don't know Kirstie, Kirstie Marie Denny is a homeschooling mom, kinesiologist, and spiritual seeker. She began her professional life as an ecologist, but was not so subtly nudged in the direction of holistic health and energy work by the experience of chronic illness and depression in her mid-20s. Having overhauled her lifestyle and regained her health in order to start a family, she was presented with her next great challenge in the form of two very wise and baffling little teachers. Despite doing everything right, in quotation marks, in terms of natural pregnancy and birth and a conscious approach to parenting, she was met with a roller coaster ride of parenting high needs, firecracker children with multiple health challenges and sensitivities. These experiences prompted a fascination with the idea of neurodivergence and its relationship with being sensitive and the deeper meaning behind so many children and adults receiving diagnoses of autism, ADHD, etc. Kirstie's mission is to assist sensitives and out-of-the-box people to thrive while embodying their unique magic. Oh, I'm so thrilled to dive into this about those terms and what they mean and if they help or if they don't. Kirstie, let's start things off with the topic of the day, neurodiversity controversy. What do you mean by that? And what is going on with the kids?
Yeah, because the word neurodiversity is used a lot now, and it's almost kind of trendy. Everyone's getting a diagnosis now. And to be completely honest, it's not entirely clear what it means. But generally, when we're talking about neurodiversity, we're talking about presentations like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, OCD, all these types of things. And I like to kind of lightheartedly say it's like, you know, the alphabet soup kids. They've got their name and then they've got a whole bunch of letters after their name with all of the diagnoses. And so it's controversial because, you know, like with many kind of hot button issues, you get these different camps forming around it. Mm. Yeah. So the people who think it's not really a thing, you've got the people who say, you know, it's just a natural diversity in neurology. This is where the term neurodiversity comes from. And it comes with lots of strengths. You've got the people who are trying to fix it. And there's a lot of similarities between all of these camps, but there's also a lot of angst and disagreement and, polarized views. So it's a very interesting topic to look at for sure.
That's right. And I think there will be people listening that will have very strong views, which we love. We love a range of views. We love the ability to ask the questions and not feel silly. Like sometimes I like to ask questions because I'm like, I genuinely don't know, or I think someone listening will be wondering what I'm wondering. And so I love that we're going to have hopefully some good mail, you know, some messages coming in 2057 on the text or email inbox at realitycheck.radio. If you do want to message into us during this conversation, one thing that comes to mind for me is within the household, there must often be some controversy with one parent thinking, oh, like they'll grow out of it, it's fine, or it's fine, don't label them. And the other parent going, no, no, we need to do something about it. And similarly with like in-laws, and as I like to call them, outlaws, right? The parents, you know, telling the child, you know, every mother loves when their parents or their in-laws love to tell them what to do. So same thing, there's going to be all these different views. As a mother who's been through it yourself, looking back, you know, what guidance can you share with anyone on that path today?
Mm, yeah, it is true. There is often conflict within households as well as in the wider community. And I suppose my biggest suggestion, piece of advice is see the child in front of you as a whole being, just as they are, and, you know, trust your instincts. And if you don't feel like you can trust your intuition or your kind of mama gut, dad's too, of course, but, you know, mother's intuition is a powerful thing. Practice that, because it's so important, because you're going to get all these different opinions. And at the core of it is your assessment of what's going on with my child. You see the essence of that child because you are with them more than anyone else. And so it's kind of tapping into that. And coming back to, you know, is the diagnosis helpful? It really depends. It depends on your situation. And so my personal view is that when you look at these, you know, psychiatric or psychological diagnoses, they're not really firm entities. They're just collections of traits and presentations that get grouped together for the convenience, because it is useful to have categories. Like, humans like labels and categories, because otherwise life would be incredibly chaotic and confusing. So it's a pragmatic thing to say, okay, the child's presenting in this type of a way, and is the label useful? Depends on how you use it. So say, for example, your kid's in school, they're having a really hard time, and you get a diagnosis of, say, autism, and then they receive greater understanding, they receive greater support, maybe more compassion, then that's very useful. The flip side of it is, do you get this diagnosis and some people put them in a box based on that diagnosis? So you really have to just decide what works for you. And there's pragmatic reasons people get diagnoses, like receiving some funding, receiving some respite care when they're overwhelmed, all these types of things. And as with any label, it can be really limiting depending how you use it. Do you attach to it as an identity that you don't want it to be challenged? Do you only see the limitations? So that's the downside. And you just have to look at it and say, what's right for our family, for me, for my child? And there's, I don't think there's any right or wrong answer. And the arguments over it are, you know, tend to be largely to do with, you know, like all of these things, a lack of communication, really seeing others and what their reasons are and what their experience is.
The funding is interesting, isn't it? Because I imagine in many cases, people need some sort of piece of paper or something to show that they require the extra support. So therefore they need the diagnoses to then get the extra support. What is the process for that? If you know it, I mean, I imagine there's a fee involved for people to go through that.
Yeah. So that's, you know, it can be a box ticking process. Yes. As you say, you want to get the supports, you want to have access to this, that, and the other thing. You do need usually a diagnosis. And so you can go through the public system. You can go to your GP and say, for example, I suspect maybe me or my child is ADHD or whatever it is. And they will refer you to a psych through the public system. And there's a wait time, but there's also a wait time if you go private. So if you've got health insurance, say, you might just want to, you can refer yourself. You can find someone that you think fits with your values, and you can just make an appointment and have an assessment. Yeah. And of course, the interesting thing is that the result you get might vary quite a lot depending on who you do see for that assessment. So it kind of shows how subjective that really is.
And also depending on how the child is on the day, because I imagine, like any child, you know, there'll be days when they're on and days when they're off and moody and sad and tired and whatever.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and the processes vary as well. So some of them will send you a lot of questionnaires in advance so you can give your viewpoint. If your child's in school, they'll send questionnaires to the school. And it's interesting because the reason they do that is because the child can present totally differently at home and at school because the environment's different. And so, you know, they might look more neurodivergent in one place than the other, and it can be either way around.
Let's talk about that a little bit. That is really interesting. At what I guess this is a it really depends type question, but at what point do people start picking up these things? Is this something they would notice maybe from, you know, kids generally, I would say, walk at one, talk at two. Do they generally start noticing at the age of like 3 and 4, or is it, can it just really become apparent at any age?
Yeah, it does vary a lot. So for example, with my children, I knew straight away, basically they were very intense babies. And some of that's down to physiological factors like reflux and stuff like that. But there's a lot of overlap between physiological factors and how that presents behavior-wise. And it's really well known now, for example, that the gut is often heavily involved in an autistic presentation, for example. So for some, it's apparent very early on, you know, like your baby is just different from other babies. Maybe they're more responsive, maybe they're much less responsive. But then, you know, you observe over the years and see how they are not typical. And this, yeah, there's no cutoff point really. I know people say, people get really angry in the sort of neurodiverse community when someone says to them, but aren't we all a little bit autistic? And I can see why it's annoying, because it feels like it's minimizing. Right. At the same time, it's kind of true. Like it's very gray. There's no really hard cutoff point where you're like, okay, this person's neurotypical and this person is neurodivergent. And so with some children, you'll know, you'll have an inkling very early, or people might say something to you, like the kindergarten teacher or friends, although often friends won't feel comfortable bringing it up. And then with others, it won't be noticeable until much later, if at all. And so we do get these situations where people are quote unquote masking, where they're experiencing a lot of inner turmoil or stress, but they're hiding it because they're good at that, or because they don't feel safe to express what's actually going on with them. And often girls are much kind of better at this. We're kind of like social chameleons. So girls often go under the radar, and maybe when they get to the teenage stage, they have a lot of anxiety, and that's what you see, or depression, or sometimes young women will get all these different labels or diagnoses like borderline personality, all these types of things, because it wasn't noticed when they were children that they were actually struggling.
I imagine, I don't know if it comes up, or the play dates, right? So play dates is a thing usually, you know, when your kids are, I don't know, age 4 to 10 or so, then they start telling them, they call them like, we're just hanging out, mom. It's not a play date anymore when you get to the age of like 12. It's not cool. Yeah. But play dates, I imagine some moms would be cautious about sending their child over, or maybe the mom, and the mom's not necessarily your friend, so she might maybe say to some other mom, oh, I noticed your child was you know, rocking, or was really quiet, or something like that. How does that play out for mothers when they've got a child around the play date space?
Depending how their child presents, so if they're super shy, if they're moving their bodies and interesting ways, if they're kind of explosive, that can be a really hard one. If the child is having outbursts, if they suddenly become aggressive. So for some families, it becomes really isolating. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, you know, no one's actually inviting them anymore to play dates or to the birthday parties, that type of thing. And often the social struggles can become more apparent with age, because the play becomes more nuanced. As you say, it moves into just hanging out. often it's easier when it's at that really physical play stage. You can just run and chase and go down the slide, and kind of that's what your friendship's based on. And then when it becomes more complex and you have these groups, then you have the in groups and the out groups and all of that stuff, that can become quite hard for people to manage.
Mm. Yeah, and kind of heartbreaking for the parents in a way, yeah, to manage that. And again, that within the family, that can be tricky because sometimes you might have one parent saying, oh, it is what it is, and the other parent being really, really emotional about it because your child's not being included or they're being actively not invited, which can bring up other memories for the parent or whatever. Do you have any strategies that work well or any other words of support for the parents who are in that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, with us, for example, we are homeschoolers, so our situation is quite different because, to be honest, there's a lot of neurodivergent people in the homeschooling community. You know, it's kind of like literal out-of-the-box people. And so you have to look at your situation. That works really well for us. It's obviously financially or logistically not manageable for everyone to have their kids at home. But yeah, just take a look at it and ask your child what they're experiencing. And as with all of these things, it's a great opportunity to look at our own stuff. So if you're the parent who's like, oh my goodness, it's just crushing me that my child is not included, just notice, like, were you also that child?
Mm.
Mm, because I noticed that. Both of my children are very quirky and different ways, and they're amazing. And one of them, he's more like the shy kid like me. And so when I see him standing on the outskirts of a group watching and being like, oh, I want to join in, but I just don't know how, like, that really hits me in my heart. And I'm very aware that that's because that was me. So yeah, there's no kind of hard and fast solution, but I just want to look at it. It's really useful to look at the family as a holistic unit. Mm. And so whether or not anybody in the family has a diagnosis, often, you know, the overarching theme is sensitivity. So maybe your kids are sensitive to the emotional environment. Maybe they're sensitive to EMFs. Maybe they're sensitive to different foods and chemicals and toxins. And then just look at yourself and your partner, other family members, and notice if there's these themes of sensitivity coming through that could be expressed in all sorts of different ways. Mm. So you want to look at the kind of ecosystem of the families, the nervous system, the subconscious, all of these things that kind of run through right through your genetic lineage, really. Mm.
I love what you said, or I read it out in your bio about how you had these two little teachers. And I think that's so important to remember. Well, anyone with any kids or anyone else around them, we always have the opportunity to learn from the other people in our lives. But I think that's such a lovely perspective, is to look at them as teachers. And what are they here to teach me? It's not just that I have to fix them or make them fit in when they're awkwardly standing on the sidelines. It's like, okay, what am I learning from this experience? I think it's, if we as humanity can maintain that perspective of what can I learn from this person or this situation in front of me, I think it can definitely help. I wanted to ask you earlier when we were talking about diagnoses, and it's kind of a chicken and an egg, I imagine, but are the numbers on the rise? What are things looking like from that perspective?
Mm, yeah, so that's another one of those really controversial points in terms of...
Oh, that's a controversial question.
Yeah, there are a lot of kids with diagnoses now. And so some would say that's just because we're more observant, we're better at diagnosing. These people have always been around, and I think that's partly true. And there isn't good data to look at historically, because oftentimes what we would now call autism would have been called something else, or the information's just not there. I think that is part of it. And I also think that we have a lot of toxicity in the world now. We really do. And we're coming back to that idea of these are the sensitive people. The toxicity comes in all different forms, chemical, energetic, emotional. And it's also we're in a time of rapid transformation and change. So I feel like they're probably, depending how you label them, there's more of these sensitives, if you use that overarching term. Mm-hmm. And they're here for a reason. You know, we've chosen them, they've chosen us, and they're showing us things. I often use the phrase, they're like canaries in the coal mine. So they show us things that aren't working. Like, you know, is it a good idea to have your food covered in pesticides? what's happening in the emotional environment of your home? Because so often they're picking up on that. And also what's happening in the collective, that kind of emotional soup that we all live in. They're feeling it and showing us things that aren't working so well so that we can start to shift it. Yeah. So kind of like catalysts of change.
Mm. If we choose, that's right. And if we choose to look at it like that and we think, wow, look how they're getting so effective. Okay, let's change that environment, the physical environment, the emotional environment, instead of trying to change the kid.
Mm. And it applies to the education system as well. You know, teachers are overwhelmed at the moment with kids who have an IEP, which is an individual education plan, because the standard isn't working for them. It's not the teacher's fault. It's not the kid's fault. So, you know, what are we going to do about it? That's the big question, isn't it? And I don't like to look at children as broken things to be fixed, but, you know, a lot of the time they could use some support to thrive more fully, to feel like they can drop into the physical body more fully and feel safe on this planet Earth. So I feel like it's a collective situation. So, you know, perhaps if we look at ourselves and we look at our wider community and we bring in more light and we bring in more awareness, are these children who look so uncomfortable almost being on the earth, is it going to get easier for them? Mm. Are they going to be able to more fully express who they are and their gifts? And obviously I think the answer is yes, but, you know, we've all got our opinions, so it's very interesting.
Just staying in the school ground for a moment, I was thinking as you were talking about the sensitives, and I mean, I agree, you know, that when I look at some schools and it's like open plan is not for everyone, right? And even then you take that into the adult world, like open plan office, like I get it and I love people and I'm a generator, so I'd be happy as Larry, but those that aren't, you know, and I'm thinking human design projectors, but even other, you know, coming back to the neurodivergent, whatever labels we want to put on it, it's like, it's not for everyone. And it's just not going to work for everyone, that type of environment. So I think as much as we can, it's not pandering, but like just noticing what is working, what's not working, and tailoring it. Even if someone's in a classroom and their class happens to be right outside the basketball court, let's say, and there's always kids, you know, and there's whistles blowing and there's the ball bouncing. And it's like, for some kids, they would just not even hear it. But other kids, it would be very distressing, not just distracting, but distressing. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, totally. It's that balance between, as you say, not pandering. You want to build your child's resilience and you also want to be honest about where they're at. Can they cope with that? And I've noticed there's been a little bit of backing off that open plan thing, but there was a lot of money invested in it, right? So there's a reluctance to say, oh, it's not maybe ideal for a lot of children. And if you are sensitive to light, noise, as often these children are, and I am, like, definitely a whistle is one of my most hated sounds. It drives me bonkers. And I hear, you know, like the humming of the fridge, the humming of the air conditioner. And if there's bright lights, I'm like, oh. And, you know, that's as an adult, and I'm aware and I've worked on these things a lot, and it's still hard. So it's really good to have awareness and compassion for those things that not everyone will notice, but for some, it's serious. And those kind of stresses to the nervous system build up and build up. And that's when you might have a meltdown or a shutdown or, yeah, any number of kind of what we would call negative behaviors. But there's a reason for them.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Up Your Brave show. I'm talking today to Kirsty Marie Denny on the topic of neurodiversity controversy, what's going on with our kids, and what's going on with our adults. Meaning, I imagine, so you're sharing with us your experience as an adult, you know, with the fridge and the air conditioner and things like that. I imagine even for some people listening to this interview, they might suddenly go, oh my goodness, my brother, or oh my goodness, my colleague at work. And the colleague at work might not even know, and not that it really matters in terms of the label and everything, but suddenly my hope and intention always is that we start to but also understand people even better and be more, not forgiving, but less judgmental, less reactive, more compassionate. As you said, you were awareness and compassion. That's really what I'm hoping from today's session, awareness and compassion to allow people to be who they are, because I'm a huge believer in people just being who they are and expressing the true versions of themselves and not trying to put on a mask and fit in and not trying to use numbing tactics to not feel, like, just be who you are. But I think we can, once we know these, we know that these things are, you know, we know, I guess, how to recognize and make things easier. How can we make things easier? If someone, let's say, is in the office with us, or we know that they get bothered by a sound, you know, can we do things to help accommodate? Can we say to someone, if I was working with you, Kirsty, hey, Kirsty, you actually are in my networking club. You're in my networking club. Now that, you know, is there anything I can do to make it better? And you might go, actually, what, that day that we sat beside the coffee machine instead of in the corner where we normally sat, that was really off-putting for me. And I'll be like, sweet, noted. Thank you. Next time I'll make sure I reserve the proper table.
Yeah, it's tricky because you don't necessarily know what things are triggering for people. But sometimes it's quite obvious, especially when you get to know people a little bit, that they start to get overwhelmed if there's a lot of noise or, you know, whatever it is, if the lights are too bright, if the music in the background starts getting louder, and it becomes difficult to filter out the sounds of a conversation, for example, because a lot of it's to do with the way the brain filters information. The brain's nothing, there's nothing particularly wrong with the brain, but it might be taking in too much information or filtering it differently, or different regions of the brain aren't connected up quite the same as a neurotypical person's. So it really is just a matter of getting present, noticing, and as you say, just having compassion, non-judgment, and most importantly, all of this applies to the self, right? So if we can do that for ourselves more automatically, we will do it for others. And so you'll notice in the networking club, a couple of times I sat against the wall and I was like, whoa, I feel so claustrophobic. And so now I only sit on the side where I can get out.
Right. Exit strategy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that I'm expecting an emergency, but I feel better that way. So just notice what feels good for you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it can be little things like that. And I guess for someone like you, it's like if the only seat there available was at the wall, you either take it or you say, hey, does anyone mind swapping? You know, like, and that does involve upping your brave to ask for something and make someone get out of their chair or squeeze in between two other people. So I guess there's an opportunity, a challenge there for people. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And because often the emotional aspect of that is difficult. You know, if you've always felt like you're on the outside, you feel a bit different than to ask for what you want or need. Can feel really hard. And of course, there'll be situations where it's not possible and you do just have to suck it up. You have to sit in that seat on the airplane. You have to deal with the noise. But when you can respectfully ask people whether they're willing to accommodate you without demanding it, because, you know, you've got to respect other people's boundaries too, you'll find that a lot of times they're more than willing to. And actually, they kind of love that you're being vulnerable with them.
Mm.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most people would. They'd be like, oh, yes, happy to swap, or thank you for letting us know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a post last week. I can't remember what it was about specifically, but a few people in the comments were saying that they actually used a fan at night for white noise. I think it was something about abuse in the past or something like that. Anyway, is that something that some people might do, is use a fan to kind of numb out all the other small sounds, or would that actually be more annoying?
Again, it depends on the person. So yeah, a lot of people will find that helpful. Me, for example, I like to wear earplugs. I like, absolute silence as much as possible. But it depends. It depends exactly how your brain's filtering the information and what will help you to relax, focus. Yeah, all those types of things. We used a lot of white noise for our firstborn. He was the world's worst sleeper. And so now if I hear white noise, it's like a PTSD thing. I'm like, oh, I never want to hear that again, because it reminds me of all of those hours of not sleeping and all of the crying and so on and so forth. So it's very individual.
Mm. I imagine as a young mother, when you don't really know what the situation is and you're having this very, I think you used the word intense.
Intense, yeah.
Baby. And you must have been thinking, gosh, like, I don't know what I'm doing, or why is everyone else, doing fine and it looks easy. I mean, when did you pick it up that it wasn't necessarily your mothering?
To be honest, pretty early. I mean, but that doesn't mean that it was easy. So I'd done quite a lot of preparation, for the birth and everything, and a lot of research, because I'm one of these people who likes to do their research, which made it kind of all the more jarring when this child, it was just like, I don't know what to do. Nothing's soothing him. I'm doing all the things and he's just crying and crying. And when he's not crying, he has to be moving. He had to be bounced all the time. There was no kind of gentle rocking or feeding to sleep. It was like he's on and on and on until he's unconscious for a short time, and then he's on again. But even though I was fairly aware that I knew logically that I was doing everything I could and more, and totally burning myself out in the process. But there was still the part of me that was saying, what did I do wrong for this to happen? So mum guilt, it's such a big thing, that whole, oh, what if I ate the wrong things when I was pregnant? What if I didn't take the right supplements? What if I didn't relax enough? Oh, now I'm getting stressed about not being relaxed enough.
Yeah.
What if it was because I drank too much alcohol when I was a teenager? What if? And it brings up so much stuff. And that's a big part of that, that teaching that they present us with, and that healing process for the whole family, because I just had layers and layers of grief come up. And whereas someone else would have a baby that screams and screams, and perhaps it wouldn't bring up all the same things for them.
Mm.
Mm. So it's definitely an exercise in an awareness. And it's really hard, as a mother, your instinct is to make things right for your kid. Even though there's no perfect parent and you can't fix everything, naturally, You want your child to be happy. You want them to thrive. So it's very jarring when they're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And I know that now, flash forward, I don't know how old your kids are. Are they 6 or 7 or something like that?
11 and 8. So they're quite big now.
Mm. So flash forward to your kids being 11 and 8. And now I know that you help other moms and dads who have children like this to be positive and see the good and thrive. Is that so? Can you tell me a little bit about what are some of the things, without breaking confidentiality, but what are some of the things that people come to you for?
Yeah, so there's all types of things, and a lot of it could be explosive behavior, you know, so tantrums, meltdowns, or kind of the flip side of that, where the child becomes very withdrawn, very anxious. Maybe they don't want to go out and see anyone. They just hide away in their room, those types of things. So those are some of the common things. And then you've got things like OCD, obsessive behaviors. That's quite common. It can be a way of trying to get some control back because they feel so overwhelmed. Yeah, defiant behavior or demand avoidant behavior. That's kind of the official word. If you have a child who's demand avoidant, and that's as difficult as it sounds.
Yeah. Can you explain that to me? And just for those that don't know, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, yes. What is the demand one?
Demand avoidance is basically they don't like to be told what to do. And even subtle demands can feel overwhelming. So brushing your teeth, getting dressed, going to the toilet, they're all kind of demands. And so it's like, and I'm noticing more and more of these children. We have some of this going on in our family, but I won't give more details than that. And it's really interesting to me because it's like, it's difficult, but the core value of these children is actually autonomy, right? Mm-hmm.
So and it's empowerment.
Like, so it's like they're born freedom seekers, and there's more and more of them at this time in our history. Isn't that interesting?
Good. We need it.
But then, you know, day to day, that can be incredibly challenging. And then often there's issues around, you know, these sensory things. So sensitivity to light, sound, textures, trouble eating, because that's a sensory experience.
A whole range of things.
It's a really wide array of behaviors. And the thing about it is that you could have two children who are presenting quite similarly in how they're behaving or their challenges. Their strengths as well, but the underlying reasons might be completely different. So that's the tricky part. It's kind of like a multi-dimensional jigsaw puzzle of what's creating this presentation. And how do we peel away some of the challenge and overwhelm, and so that the brilliance of this child can shine through, because we don't want to miss out on seeing the magic of who they are, because we're so caught up in, oh yeah, but there's meltdowns and they won't eat this and so on and so forth.
It's so good that you can help them with that. I was just thinking, because for some moms, right, they'll be their friend might be like, just try a star chart. That worked for my child. And they're like, oh my gosh. And it just does, try the naughty step. It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it does work for some. And of course I had a lot of these suggestions, and well, fortunately, I was always quite kind of strong in my beliefs. And so, you know, when people were like, just let the baby cry it out, I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. But, what's aligned for you, you have to get a sense of. Mm-hmm. And clearly, if you have a child, say, for example, who's demand avoidant, a star chart will be like their kryptonite. Yeah. Don't tell me what to do. Don't manipulate me, all of that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Well, it's so good. I'm hoping that through this interview, we've given people a greater awareness, and for some parents, a bit of hope, and hopefully some strategies and things. I'm going to segue to now ask you about the Up Your Brave question. Before I do that, is there any specific practical tip or strategy or thing that you wish you'd known or wish you'd done that you want to share with our listeners today before I move into the next section?
It's kind of broad, but self-compassion, that you can't always get it right and you can't always control everything about your child's journey. So you're a big part of what happens for them, but they've come into this life with kind of their own challenges, their own vision, and their own journey. And so give yourself some grace. And if you have a child who is displaying intense or challenging behavior, this is, I'm quite practiced at this, but there's still more. There's always more layers of practice, is don't take it personally. Because sometimes it can feel very personal. You know, you're being yelled at. You're getting verbal abuse. There's things being thrown. It's not about you, and they don't mean it. And they're usually in massive overwhelm. And of course, that's really hard, but it's so valuable, and it translates into life in general as well. Like, how great is it when you can just not take it personally?
Mm. Mm. And on that note, it must be important for parents to be on the same page or as close as possible, because even in a scenario like that, I can imagine one parent getting really cross at the child and the other parent being like, no, you know. So any guidance for the dads or the parents who are parenting this and going through this together? Because some people will be going through this solo, of course.
Yeah, there is often a mum-dad split, because mums tend to be the ones who do all this research and come from that place of that deep heart connection. And fathers have that natural role of not being disciplinary necessarily, but maintaining some boundaries and structure and saying, actually, that's not okay. And it's this delicate balance, because you need some boundaries, but it's about holding the boundaries with compassion. And it's challenging, and you really just need to communicate with each other. Almost like set aside times to discuss, like, what is our approach? Where are you coming from with your approach to this? What does it trigger in you when this happens? Like, if the child's angry and they're screaming, what's coming up for you? What are you feeling? And for some couples, you know, they probably will really need to see a counselor and see that as an investment in their parenting journey if they're kind of diametrically opposed. That's very hard.
And I suppose in a way you sometimes become that third party who actually facilitates some of those conversations, like, how are we going to manage this? And how do you feel when the child does that? And then sometimes it is helpful having somebody else ask those questions.
Yeah, that's right. And it's so important to look at, the parents' stuff and the parents' nervous system health, the parents' mental health, your energy. And it's so easy to just say, everything I've got is going to the kid, but they're feeding off what's coming from you. So you need to, self-care. It's such a cliche, but you really, it's very important when you are in this intense environment.
So true. And if there's another child, of course, making sure that child gets the attention and love, not just, right?
That's right. And that they're safe, those basics. Yeah.
Amazing. All right. So, Kirsty, if you were to truly up your brave in the remainder of 2024, what would you do?
I would say, in a broad sense, it's just about becoming more and more authentic. And, and that doesn't look like being really loud and out there for me. It's different for everyone. I'm friendly, but I'm a massive introvert. And so what it is, it's just an alignment between the heart and the head, and practicing speaking that truth more and more often, and just noticing where that takes me. And it might be sometimes that I'm sharing my work more, I'm getting out there more. And at other times it will be the honesty to say, you know what, I need to stay at home today and just chill and just rest. Radical honesty.
Yeah. And listening, what I'm hearing from you is like listening to yourself and then honoring that, not just saying, okay, well, I need to get myself together and get out the door. And
that pushing through. So it's, that's kind of a boring answer, but I think that's the truth. It's that alignment of, when's the time for pushing forward? When's the time for just being in ease?
Amazing. Yeah. How can people follow you? How can they connect with you online if they're wanting to learn more or book a session with you? I know you're in Auckland, but you do stuff online as well.
Yeah. So At the moment, probably the best place to find me is on my Facebook. So that's you can find me under Kirsty Denny or Kirsty Marie Energy, which is my business name. And so I post information and offers on there. I have a website, which is kirstymariedenny.com, but it's currently being edited. So watch that space.
All right. We're going to spell Kirsty Marie for our listeners. K-I-R-S-T-Y. Mm-hmm. Marie, M-A-R-I-E.
Yep.
Amazing. All right. So your website is a work in progress, but you've got some offers coming up. What is coming up for you in terms of work or life in general in the coming months?
So I'm just releasing an offer. So you'll be able to find it on my Facebook and I'll share it various places. And it's called the Wild Child Offer. So do you have a wild child? And of course, they might not look wild. They might look quiet, but you know. And what that is, it's an online session, a 45-minute session where you can talk to me about what's going on, can see what's coming up sort of energetically, intuitively, and then use kinesiology. So I can do muscle testing remotely. So I can muscle test on myself and as a surrogate, basically, and just see kind of like what the priorities are, because there's so many options. You know, the child is having volatile episodes. What is it? Like, what's kind of coming up energetically? Is it to do with EMFs? Is it to do with them being so empathic that they're feeling everybody else's emotional stuff? Would it be beneficial to have a change of diet or to reduce toxins? And I can provide feedback for prioritization and also give you tools, so energetic tools, things you can do for balancing the meridians, things you can do to help balance and integrate the brain and to bring just overall more balance to the system. So that's an online session and it's a great little way to get a taste of what I do and to get some real value out of it in terms of what can I do right now to assist my child and also myself.
Mm. Amazing.
Yeah.
That's so great. I will put the links, all of your links to the Facebook and that as well on the replay page, everybody. So if you go to realitycheck.radio or you look it up on the apps, go to replays, up your brave, and you'll see it there. Okay, so before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd love to share with our audience today? We've covered so many things that I think will be really helpful for people. Anything else you want to finish off with?
I would just say, if you're a parent, if you're a caregiver and you're feeling kind of overwhelmed or you're feeling alone, just know that whatever's going on, it's not your fault. Your child isn't a broken thing that needs fixing, but there may be a lot of ways to support them and to bring them energetically more into alignment so that they can really share their beauty with you more fully. They can be more present in their body on this earth and bring through that magic. Yeah. So know you're not alone and know that, you're a gift. Your child is a gift.
Beautiful.
And yeah.
Thank you so much, Kirsty, for joining us today. And thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.